Shalom, everyone. I'm Rabbi John Spirosavet, and this is an introduction to a few conversations about the Festival of Purim and the months of Adar in the Jewish calendar. I'm recording this on March 7th, 2024, the 27th day of Adar Aleph in 5784, which I mention because it's the first Purim since October 7th, 2023. I started thinking about this particular Purim even before last Chanukah was over, in December of 2023. I have always loved Purim, and the Chag, the festival, has deepened for me at every stage of my adult life, starting in college. But this winter, I found myself both grasping for Purim more than ever, and wondering how we could possibly celebrate this year. October 7th was itself a festival. It was Simchat Torah in Israel. As I am recording today, the subsequent war is still going on, with thousands dead and wounded, Israelis and Palestinians, more than 130 hostages still in captivity in Gaza, and so much human suffering and ongoing trauma. On the one hand, Purim seems so on the nose right now, an attack on Jews seemingly out of nowhere, the mobilization of Jews everywhere in armed response and in advocacy to the world's superpower, and in some cases Jews have gone back to masking themselves, especially at some universities. Usually at this time of year, I'd be making or sharing funny videos like this one.
It's Rabbi John.
And welcome to Adar, the Jewish month when Purim happens. Do you need a holiday for our crazy topsy-turvy times? Then look no further.
But the thought of celebrating through all this seems almost profane. On the other hand, I have long thought that Esther is the text and Purim is the Chag that are most true to modern Jewish experience, especially in the diaspora. So maybe the Megillah and Purim are here to catch us this year. Maybe there is an Esther-informed spiritual therapy that will at least hold up a clear mirror for us, and perhaps even guide us, or at least map our situation a little better. I know how much I need that. So here is a first sketch of that map, and the ways the story of Esther, the Megillah, and the Festival of Purim might be what we need right now. These elements I hope to follow up in conversations with other Jewish teachers between now and Purim, and with any of you. I want to start with a sort of cryptic description of the biblical Jews of Imperial Persia at the time of Esther's story, from a midrash found in the Babylonian Talmud, Masechet Shabbat, page 88a. For those who are viewing this as a video, I'm putting the Talmudic passage on the screen. And if you're watching or listening on a podcast, the text will be in the show notes. Feel free to pause and pull it up to follow along, but you don't have to look at it or remember it. I'll keep going back to it and picking up its components. The Midrash starts with a quote from the story of the Israelites standing at Mount Sinai about 800 years before Purim, give or take. The quote is part of a verse from Exodus 19 about the giving of the Ten Commandments, which says, "And they stood beneath the mountain." Rav Avdimi Bar Chama Bar Chasa said, "This verse teaches that the Blessed Holy One inverted the mountain above them like a vat and said to them, 'If you accept the Torah, that's good, and if not, there will be your grave.'" Rav Acha Bar Yaakov said, "From here there's a substantial piece of knowledge that is an objection to the Torah." Rava said, "Even so, they went back and accepted it in the days of Ahasuerus, as it is written toward the end of the book of Esther, 'The Jews fulfilled and accepted,' meaning they fulfilled what they had previously accepted." End of Talmudic quote. It's in kind of a code. The analogies aren't obvious to today, but I want to poke and pull at this text because it's going to be helpful. The starting point is a comparison between the Jews of Mount Sinai and the Jews of Shushan, the Persian imperial capital at the time of Queen Esther. And in this comparison in the Talmud, it's the Jews of Shushan who come out way higher. That seems crazy, or at least very unexpected. There should be no comparison at all between the Jews in our most holy book, the Torah, and the Jews of the silliest of our holidays. Yeah, both groups are in the larger Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh. But the Jews of the Megillah are just barely in the Bible, according to many of the rabbis of the Talmud, who thought about leaving the book of Esther out entirely. In the Torah, there are the Jews of the Mount Sinai generation, who received a direct divine communication, who were eating every day manna, food that came to them in a direct delivery from the divine down from the sky. The Jews at Sinai were experiencing Torah on a regular basis as a fresh and brand new teaching, full of mitzvot, full of very specific responsibilities and wisdoms. In the Megillah, there are Jews, but they are so different. The only Jewish thing about them was that they called themselves Jews, except when they didn't, because they didn't want people to know that they were Jews. And then they named themselves after Persian divinities like Ishtar and Marduk. At the start of the Megillah, there aren't even any Jews mentioned at all. If it wasn't in Hebrew, you wouldn't even know it's a Jewish book. When we do first meet Mordechai, a Jew willing to identify himself publicly, the only substantive Jewish thing about him is that he wouldn't bow down to another person. The Megillah generation of Jews don't seem like Torah people or God-connected people at all. So how could Rava, in this midrash in the Talmud, say that without those Jews, we couldn't have a valid Torah? Well, for one thing, the Jews of the Megillah live in the Persian Empire, a huge area of 127 provinces, each of them culturally and ethnically distinct. Jews live everywhere among all of these peoples, at a time when some Jews also live in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel. The Jews at Mount Sinai are living in a one-of-a-kind world in the wilderness, all by themselves, not in their land yet, and not really anywhere. So score one for the Jews of the Megillah is more relevant for us Jews today than the Jews of the Torah. Rava in the Talmud might be saying that it's easy to accept Torah when God talks to you directly and everyone around you has had that same experience. But it's Jews like the ones in the Megillah whose commitments are more like our commitments. And until Jews like the ones in the Megillah decide what they are committed to, the Torah isn't fully here in the world. Then we've got this idea of Rav Avdimi Bar Chama Bar Chassa about God turning Mount Sinai upside down over the Jews' head and threatening to drop it on top of them. That's so weird. But the Midrash works in metaphors, and part one of this metaphor is the Hebrew word for inverting, which is kafa, the Hebrew letters kaf, fe, he. It means both to turn something upside down and also to coerce. And wouldn't you know that in the Megillah, one of the key words is a word for turning something upside down. It's got the same three letters, but in reverse order. Instead of kafa, it's hafach, he, fe, chaf. And the way the Megillah described things in its world is v'nahafochu, things got turned upside down. In the Megillah, one of the big themes is that everything gets turned upside down over and over. The story starts with peace for Jews, then comes a threat from Haman, boo, and then he gets the king's support. Then Esther gets the king on board on our side. At the start, the king gets sick of one queen, Vashti, because she's headstrong and might provoke a feminist movement. Then he chooses a seemingly opposite queen, Esther, who seems hidden and meek, but then she turns into a very powerful feminist mastermind. The Jews are nondescript members of this huge empire, then astonished at what's happening, and then defend themselves with force. The Jewish world in the Megillah turns upside down again and again. So why does Rav Avdimi say that Mount Sinai is the thing that's upside down? I think what Rav Avdimi is saying is that there is something upside down about the way the Torah presents the world, upside down in a way that can also be oppressive. The Torah makes the world seem very orderly and coherent. Obey these mitzvot and things will go well. Or break the covenant and things will fall apart. There's a mitzvah for every situation and every experience. Even the way the Jews live in the wild, scraggly wilderness for 40 years is in a camp organized in a geometric pattern, an order imposed on nothingness. But Rav Dimi is saying that's actually upside down thinking. The world isn't like that, and it's oppressive to think that it is. If all you can think of is that moral behavior gets rewarded and immoral behavior gets punished, you're going to feel completely topsy-turvy when that's so obviously not what's happening. Or you're going to feel like a huge mountain is about to collapse on top of you. In contrast, the Jews of the Megillah know that life is not that consistent or coherent. Jewish experience is unpredictable, and it flips from terror to celebration and back and forth many times. Morality is not always rewarded. The divine is not clearly evident in the Esther story. If we seek the divine there, we have to be ready to perceive divinity in ways that are not revelations everyone sees. It's more right side up to understand all that and accept it, and then to decide anyway to live right, because it's the right thing to do, not because the world always makes sense. So score 2 for the Jews of the Megillah, who can find a way to be grounded in Torah wisdom, even when they don't know which way is up. That's where we are, especially this year, when the shock of October 7th and the aftermath, and the shock of how people around us have reacted to it, have been dizzying for months on end. The metaphor of the upside-down mountain has a part two, and it's the way that Mount Sinai is compared to a vat that is held over the Jew's head. It's an unusual word in the Talmud, gigit in Hebrew, and it might well refer to a vat of wine. Why does Rav Avdimi compare Mount Sinai to a huge open vat of wine about to be dumped out on top of us? You might have said that the Torah is the most sober thing in Judaism, serious business about laws and responsibilities and our history. The Megillah, though, starts off with a 6-month drinking party in honor of King Ahasuerus, and every time something significant happens in the story, there's drinking. And in another place in the Talmud, it says that on Purim you're supposed to get drunk or into an intoxication-like or dreamlike state of mind called ad delo yada, until you don't know. Specifically, until you don't know the difference between cursed is Haman, boo, and blessed is Mordechai, arur Haman, woo, and baruch Mordechai. You're supposed to get yourself that disoriented. In the Midrash in the Talmud, it's Mount Sinai that's being compared to a whole lot of wine. And Rav Acha bar Yaakov says, hey, this is a big thing to know about the Torah. Knowing this is connected to not knowing the difference between Mordechai and Haman, boo. It's the same Hebrew root word, moda'a and lo yada. I think Rav Acha is saying that the Torah on its own, without the Megillah, is overpromising what you can know for sure. The Jews standing at Mount Sinai didn't know as much as we think they did. But the Jews in the Megillah were in a constant state of not knowing enough about their situation and even about themselves. At a key moment in the Megillah, when Mordechai gets word to Queen Esther about the plot against the Jews, he tells her, who knows if for a time like this you've become royal? Mi yodea. He doesn't say he knows for sure that's why she's queen, like it was obviously divinely ordained. Instead, he just says, who knows, maybe. So act like it's true, because it's the only way to act that makes sense at all. The Megillah says, even when you're not sure, even when you don't know, act on the basis of what you can know, which is how to be there for people and for what's right. Purim is not about getting drunk or escaping, but coming back from those states and getting clear about some things. Recognize what complete moral unclarity feels like, so we can look into our regular messy world with moral clarity. So score a third point for the Jews of the Megillah over the Jews of Mount Sinai. We have to figure out, too, this year, what it means to act out of solidarity with Jews and with suffering Palestinians when we really aren't sure what our situation is and what our power is. We have to seek some moral clarity in a world of so much moral confusion. I'll say here a quick thing about the Purim theme of masks. The Jews of the Torah were really by themselves in the desert, just them and God. So they didn't have this issue of deciding how or whether to reveal themselves to other groups of people. The Jews of the Megillah were interwoven with the 127 other peoples of the empire and were very much in the dance of showing themselves versus blending in versus wondering how dangerous it was to be in the open. That's a fourth way that the Jews of Shushan are relevant to us in a way the Jews of Mount Sinai aren't as much. A fifth thing is the figure of Esther herself as a leader and rescuer, along with Mordechai, in comparison to Moshe and the other leaders of his time. I can't even sum up this theme for this introduction, but I very much want to talk about that and expand on it in one of my upcoming conversations. But I do want to say something here about the response to anti-Semitism, which is this year the major reason Purim is so relevant. For the Jews at Mount Sinai, it was clear what to do about Pharaoh and about the nation of Amalek, who had attacked the Jews shortly before they got the Torah. Be separate, get away, fight back, trust God. I'm oversimplifying, of course, and even if it was clear, it wasn't easy to do these things. But for the Jews of the Megillah, when the threat came on the scene through Haman, Boo, who derives from the same nation of Amalek, it wasn't clear at all what to do or what to think. Especially in Shushan, the capital, the Jews at first are simply astonished and confused. And we can relate to that this year. They weren't deciding to separate from their surroundings or to go to Eretz Yisrael, which they could have done with no one stopping them and without an army, unlike the Jews of Mount Sinai. The Jews of the Megillah don't say that King Ahasuerus is like Pharaoh. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Under Esther's leadership, they eventually make the king their key ally. Eventually, they do defend themselves, and they go on the offensive. This year, for the first time, I think I understand emotionally what it means in the Megillah that the king could not just rescind his edict. It's not that simple. In the story, no one knows just how supportive all the people of the empire are to the anti-Semitic edict, deep down, the one inspired by Haman, once it's said out loud, Haman, boo. The Jews certainly responded with overwhelming force. All of it is so familiar. But Esther ordains that when they look back on all this afterward, they can't just write down all the horrible things that happened and how they gathered with other Jews and fought back. They would also give meals to their neighbors, mishloach manot, and gifts to poor people, matanot la'evyonim. Somehow they would need to integrate a fierce fighting spirit with a generous one when they looked back and retold this story. They would use the story of anti-Semitism and topsy-turvy not to say that self-protection is the whole answer for Jews, not to say that turning inward is the only option, but to build community on the basis of love and to radiate generosity despite it all. And I think the Megillah means not just to other Jews. Esther's new festival of Purim would be about the threat to Jews and about Jewish power and about Jewish values. It would actually be a microcosm of the most important things about Jewish community and history and the ethics of Judaism, a huge threat and the best things about us rolled into one festival. That's Rava's point in the Talmud about why we should see the Jews of Shushan as the ones who really got the Torah, even more than the Jews of Mount Sinai. It's why our tradition compares Purim to Yom Kippur, the single most morally intense day of the Jewish year. So, score a 6 point for the Jews of the Megillah as relevant uniquely for us today, even more than the Jews of the Torah. I am saying this last part about anti-Semitism and the Megillah's idea of how we respond with far more certainty than I actually have. It's what I want to believe, what I want to know. But this is the conversation I most want to open up, hopefully in another recording in this series, and with anyone who wants to talk about it more, one-on-one or in a group. Drop a note to the email address in the notes or on the screen if you're watching, whether it's Adar of 5784 or any time you find this. So that's the map I'd like to explore between now and Purim of 5784, the Purim after October 7th. These are the building blocks of Esther-informed spiritual therapy, which is the support I know I need right now. Read the text of the Megillah yourself, the book of Esther, with all this in mind. Maybe we can help each other figure out what kind of joyful communal celebration might be appropriate for this Purim, if such a celebration is possible, and not profane in a time like now. What kind of chag would be not just fun for the kids, but right for us, in a way that's true toward the upside down in our lives right now, and in the lives of those who are suffering most among our Jewish people, and among the Palestinians with whom we Jews are so interwoven. I hope this introduction helps. To be continued together.